What happened to music that meant something?
The Who at the Kingdom or Kiss at the Coliseum. Where is the Misty Mountain Hop? Where is the smoke on the water? Where is the Iron Man of today?
Hey, this is not a test. This is rock and roll.
Welcome to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. I'm Jim DeRogatis, the pop music critic at the Chicago Sun-Times.
And I'm Greg Cott. I write about rock and roll for the Chicago Tribune. Today, on the world's only rock and roll talk show, it is that time of year, Jim. It is not Christmas, but as far as the record companies are concerned, they are releasing albums as if Christmas were tomorrow.
Yeah, between now...
these are the big releases of the big year.
Between now and Thanksgiving, it's nonstop. This is when the record industry does a huge percentage of its business. Barely have we recovered, Greg, from summer concert season, out at these festivals that go 14 hours a day in the 110-degree heat, and now we've got the onslaught of the biggest releases of the year in terms of new albums. But at least, you know, when we're reviewing these, we can sit at home without our pants on and listen in our own leisure. That's why I don't go into the office. Yeah, they don't like to let me play loud music and write in my shorts.
That's one way to work from home, yeah. So with that in mind, with that picture in the back of my mind, Jim, I'm going to try to concentrate on the fact that we have these albums to review, including the new one from The Roots, great hip-hop group out of Philadelphia. Khalees, can't wait to hear what her new one sounds like.
How do you follow Milkshake?
Yes, I mean, how do you follow up Milkshake? One of the biggest singles of 2003, 2004. Her fourth album is here. Khalees was here. Plus, we've got two cool indie releases from Cursive and M. Ward. We've got the new one from Audioslave. And then we have this guy. I think everybody will know exactly who we're talking about as soon as they hear that voice.
Ain't talking, just walking. Hot burning, still yearning. No one on earth would ever know.
Okay, you got three guesses.
There's only one voice like that.
Yes, indeed. That is the Bard himself, Bob Dylan, back with his first album in 5 years called Modern Times, his 44th. In a career that stretches back to the early 60s.
That's just studio albums. Forget about the live albums.
Oh, my God. And not to mention the bootlegs that his fans so obsessively collect. It's a modest 10-song record that he's put out this time, recorded very quickly with his touring band, produced by one Jack Frost,
yeah,
a.k.a.
I love that.
Bob Dylan.
He's done the last two under that pseudonym.
And it's interesting,
what a card.
Jim, because he's in the news as the producer of his new record. Dylan made a little bit of news in the last week by saying that I don't know anybody who's made a record that sounds decent in the past 20 years, really. And he was talking not just about some artistic shortcomings that he sees in the music, but also the way records sound, perpetually dissatisfied with the sound
Jacob.
Of records.
Right? Yeah. I mean, as if that kid doesn't have enough problems being Bob Dylan's son. You know, the Wallflowers, I guess, would be included there.
Indeed, yes.
As well as the rest of popular music in the last two decades, yeah.
His quote is, you listen to these modern records, they're atrocious. They have sound all over them. There's no definition of nothing, no vocal, no nothing, just like static. Even these songs probably sounded 10 times better in the studio when we recorded them. CDs are small. There's no stature to it.
So what does he do? He makes a record that sounds like it was recorded in 1920. Which is... See, you can never... I think the thing that people don't understand, and I'll just inject this right here, is you can never forget that Dylan is the most archly ironic, perverse imp in the history of popular music.
Exactly.
You know, the guy's famously sarcastic.
Exactly. You know, calling the record Modern Times.
Modern Times.
Making a record that sounds, as you said, like it was recorded in 1920. Like
complete with the vinyl crackles of a, not even like of an LP, of a 78 RPM on a Victrola.
Exactly. No post-rock and roll sounds were used or made on this record. It's all about early blues. It's all about early vaudeville. It's all about parlor songs, folk songs, done very much live, the way they probably recorded in the 20s, 30s, and 40s.
And you can hear mistakes.
Before there were overdubs.
You can hear gaffes. It's all part of its charm. So I think what Dylan was actually saying there, you know, famously a punk rocker who's never been named that, he's basically advocating, you know, immediacy is the way to go with recording.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about this a little bit more once we play a full track from this record. But I think it's interesting the way Dylan has recorded his voice on this record and the way his band plays behind him on this record. He is making a record that I think really doesn't sound like anything else that's out there at the moment. And we'll give you a little taste of it.
We're going to play a track that's interesting here. Again, as you were saying, Dylan's head is in the 20s, the 30s, the 40s with vaudeville, with country blues. But the guy slays me. I think he's one of the funniest artists in history. Here is this song where he's name-checking. And if you ask me, I think he's sounding a little hot for a current R&B superstar.
You think?
I think he's lusting after. It's called Thunder on the Mountain. And look at who he's chasing down here in this song.
Thunder on the mountain and as far as the moon. The ruckus in the alley and the sun will be here soon. Today's the day you're gonna grab my trombone blue. Well, it's hot stuff here and it's everywhere I go. I was thinking about Lizzie Keys. Couldn't keep them quiet when she was born in Hill's Kitchen. I was living down the line. I'm wondering where in the world Lizzie Keys could be. I've been looking for her even clear through Tennessee. Feel like my soul is beginning to expand. Took you to my heart and you will sort of understand. You brought me here, now you're trying to run me away. The writing on the wall, come read it, come see what it says.
Bob Dylan, Thunder on the Mountain, from the new album Modern Times. I'm wondering where in the world Alicia Keys could be. I've been looking for her even clear through Tennessee. Yeah, Bob, it ain't exactly Masters of War, is it?
No, it's not, but you mentioned the humor, and I think the humor in Dylan lately has just sharpened to a level that is really admirable. The other thing that I really like about his singing lately, he's sort of developed this conversational voice that I think I heard for the first time from him in his 2004 memoir, Chronicles, Volume 1, where all of a sudden the veils of mystery just sort of dropped.
Right.
And here you saw this human being talking to you like a normal person. Like,
well,
Dylan was suddenly, I mean, clearly
I don't know if it was normal, because there's the six pages where he waxes rhapsodic about the genius of Tiny Tim.
But it was funny.
Yes, it's very funny. It's not normal. Don't ever call Bob normal.
I just felt like there was a sense of intimacy there that I had not seen in a lot of his work.
Yes.
Up to that point, I always felt like he was playing a bunch of card games with me.
Well, he still
as a
is.
Listener.
He still is, but he's finally, as a great magician, he's finally kind of showing you the joke.
Uh-huh, exactly.
He's letting, if you're smart enough to listen, I think it would be easy to dismiss this album as, what is he doing here with these 20s and 30s tunes? And
it is odd. There's no doubt about
It's very strange. Let's get some things in perspective. Dylan has been, no doubt about it, at age 65, he's in looking back on his career mode. He did Chronicles Volume 1. He let Martin Scorsese come in and do the authorized biography, No Direction Home. In both cases, he's still playing with the enigma of Bob Dylan, and I think he's been more honest in his last three records than he has anywhere else. But there is this obsession with the sounds pre-rock and roll. He's fascinated with the first half of the last century. And the dominant sound on this album is that country blues shuffle. That simple snare drum with the brushes, right? And that's fine. It's nothing new. We've heard it from him before. I mean, it's essentially Maggie's Farm writ large over three quarters of this album. That's fine, because the lyrics are funny and Dylan's singing better than he ever has, arguably. Not that he ever sings well. And the backing band is one of the finest he has ever had. My problem comes in the other quarter of the album, which is devoted to this bizarre fascination with Bing Crosby and Rudy Valley crooning. I can't follow him there. I mean, I don't, maybe I'm not sophisticated enough in the intricacies of the great American songbook of the last half of the last century, but boy, it just kills me. And there's a couple of those tracks which just ruin the album for me. Spirit on the Water, When the Deal Goes Down, and Beyond the Horizons. I just can't listen to him, Greg.
Yeah, the Spirit on the Water is pretty schmaltzy, although you get to lines even in that song, I can't go to paradise no more, I killed a man back there.
Stuff like
this just pops out of these weird contexts. Here's this kind of Bing Crosby beautiful ballad type song, and suddenly he's talking about killing a man. I can't go back there anymore because, oh yeah, I killed a guy back there.
Well, he's got this Old Testament thing that's running wild over this whole, you know, vindictive God, and there is no hope of redemption except perhaps in the arms of my one true love, but she's probably going to drown in the flood.
Well, I think the key, well said. I mean, you know, he's always, and people sort of read a lot into this, like, oh, it's so dark and depressing, but constantly, even in the most dark, depressing themes in this record, he's finding these weird comical moments. So he's basically saying that truth, beauty, and humor are going to show up in the most unexpected places. When we least expect them to show up, they are going to come along and they are going to make our lives worth living. I think he's very much in the moment in this record. The intimacy in his voice, I think, is really refreshing. There's none of that sort of gargly rasp that has really weighed down his shows in the last few years. But I think the big downfall, Jim, overall for me musically is that it is not up to the standards of Love and Theft in 2001 and Time Out of Mind in 1997, because the band seems to be a little bit cowed by him.
Yeah.
It's one of his new touring bands. He's consistently rejiggering the lineup. And this latest group of guys, and I noticed this when he was on tour about a year ago, they're sort of tiptoeing around him a little bit still.
Yeah, they're still a great band, but they were afraid of the boss, and they didn't want to cut loose.
Yeah.
What was great about that last stretch when he was still playing guitar is he would allow the musicians to kick his butt.
Exactly.
And he liked it. It was almost like, bring it on.
And these guys sound like they're still learning the songs as they're playing them. They're sort of walking
on eggshells. Well, they probably are.
Yeah,
they probably are. You know, he walks in the studio, plays it once, and they record it.
And there you go. There's another one of the problems he has with modern production techniques, as I said. You know, it's, you're too well rehearsed. You guys know the stuff too well. I want in the moment, you know.
And, no tuners.
But it takes a special group of people to do that. And, you know, I'm not quite sure he got there. He tried that same thing on Love and Theft, and he nailed it. On this one, he didn't quite get there. So
Those are both better albums. The last two records are both better. So you're saying it's a good album, but here at Sound Opinions, and we're going to use this a lot tonight, we rate things on our trademarked rating scale of buy it. Obviously, we're saying go out and spend your hard-earned money, burn it. You better sample it first. You better listen a little bit, see if it's worth your cash, and trash it. Self-explanatory. So where are you actually going to tell people to buy this?
I'm going to tip the scale on buy it, Jim, for only one reason. Everybody needs to hear him sing, I got the pork chops, she got the pie, when he's talking about Alicia Keys.
Well, I'm with you, but those Rudy Valley songs are killer. I would say burn, not that I'm endorsing illegal downloading, mind you, I would say burn the good tracks here, certainly him lusting after Alicia, but I can't say buy the whole record.
All right, Jim, so that's a burn it for you and a buy it for me.
Let's see where we stand on this next one. This is arguably the best-selling hard rock band in America today, their third album. That phlegm-throated banshee wail belongs to none other than Chris Cornell. One time leader of Soundgarden, among many other endeavors, there's like an 8 or 12-page fashion spread in the current Esquire magazine. He's not dressing grunge no more. He's high style. He has just recorded the new James Bond theme song, mm-hmm. right? And he opened a restaurant in Paris.
Wow.
Who would have ever thunk?
A man of many talents.
That a guy who was part of the grunge revolution in the 90s is now a Parisian restaurateur. he is also in this new band, Audioslave, has been now for this the third album, with the remnants of Rage Against the Machine. Tom Morello, a genius guitarist from Libertyville out here in the Chicago suburbs, a guy who pretty much reinvented hard rock guitar in the mid-90s, bringing to it the propensity to mimic the sounds of scratching turntables and dive bombers and strangled chickens and all sorts of amazing noises sounding nothing like a guitar. Playing against this rhythm section of Tim Comerford and Brad Wilk, Morello is going around saying the goal for Revelations, the new album by Audioslave, was to combine Led Zeppelin and Earth, Wind, and Fire. I don't know how that's any different, because basically that's what he's been doing since the start of Rage Against the Machine, and certainly through the first two Audioslave albums, with Cornell replacing Zach Della Rocca, who used to be the vocalist of Rage Against the Machine. Whatever happened to that guy? Now we have this new Audioslave record, which I'm not going to tip my hand in the review, but I think it's safe to say right up here, Greg, that it ain't that much different from the last two Audioslave records. Well, with the one exception. There was no hint of politics, not in the lyrics. Morello remains one of the most committed activists in rock today, and I can't imagine that he was necessarily happy that Audioslave no longer had the intellectual content, the political content that was present in Rage Against the Machine. But this is the compromise that the three Ragers struck with Cornell, who continued to sing mainly solipsistic songs about his life. It's hard to be Chris Cornell being a Parisian restaurateur and going through divorces and stuff like that. But now, all of a sudden, a little bit of politics here in Revelations, the third Audioslave album, most notably on this song, which is called Wide Awake.
You can look up.
Wide Awake from the new Audioslave record Revelations, their third album, multi-platinum for the first two records. This one bound to debut in the top five, if not number one. And as you mentioned, Jim, Wide Awake with the political references, trading lives for oil as if the whole world was blind. You know, the chorus in that song to me illustrates the fundamental problem with this band. Listen to the chorus, the quote-unquote catchiest part of this song. The lyrics say, I find you guilty of a crime of sleeping at a time when you should have been wide awake.
Wow.
I mean, that's a
that's
mouthful.
Profound.
That doesn't say anything.
That's after
and it's a mouthful of mush. And you
that's
know,
after he tells us he looked the hurricane in the eyes.
There's just a clumsy, mismatched kind of feel to this band. From the start,
yeah.
It appeared that way, and it's just gotten worse album
dreadful.
After album.
I want to underscore here. You and I have covered Tom Morello from the beginning of his career. He's been a guest on Sound Opinions. Incredible musical talent, incredible brain. Tom, this band sucks so bad. You know, it breaks my heart because I was not impressed by the debut. I liked even less Audioslave number two. And now this record, I mean, Cornell apparently thinks that singing about politics means mentioning the word riot a whole lot. There's no need to apologize for the riot in your eyes, and the original fire has died, but the riot lives on. Listen, the most political act that this music is going to inspire is some skate punk picking his nose in public.
Yeah.
This album is like as interesting as a bingo game at St. Agatha's on a Tuesday night.
It's difficult to listen to. I mean, Cornell's voice, he's got a great voice if you're talking about those kind of slow burn psychedelic dirges that Soundgarden specialized
Black Hole Sun.
In. You know, I mean, wonderful sound. I can't fault that. But here the band is trying to get funky. You know, that sort of Earth, Wind, and Fire comparison isn't really specious. They are trying to get a little bit of soul. They got some tambourines rattling in there, and they're trying some more funk rhythms. You know, that rhythm section, though, is pretty stiff. Cornell sounds just completely out of his element trying to sing over that kind of a rhythm
bed.
That
guy's a bozo. I don't understand why anybody
Morello, meanwhile,
ever...
here's the latest riff I've invented, and it's pretty cool.
Well, this is a trash it, right?
Oh, yeah. No,
if I had four copies, I'd trash them all.
The only revelation here is that this band is really bad. Audioslave, I'm sorry.
When we come back, we hope we're going to hear some more good records. We've got more reviews for you. Two cool indie releases from Cursive and M. Ward, and two of the most anticipated hip-hop or R&B records this year from Khalees and The Roots. You can hear all of these record reviews from the show again by going to our website and clicking on the read section at soundopinions.org. We'll be right back with Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media.
cause I'm a boss.
You're listening to Sound Opinions on Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media, and that is Khalees from the new album Khalees Was Here. Big single called Bossy, follow-up to one of the biggest songs of 2004, Milkshake. Boy, oh boy, was that song everywhere.
That song is just
everything.
So great. They're just, when you say that word, Milkshake, I just, my Milkshake is better than, I mean, I love that song.
I could teach you, but I have to charge.
Yeah.
And I mean, every girl, every school girl in America knew those lines and was singing that song in
it
the back
like
of the school bus.
Classic playground
in the schoolyard.
Rhyme.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. But, you know, on her third album, from which Milkshake was drawn, Khalees basically talked about sex as the greatest hors d'oeuvre of them all. You know, there's this whole notion of sexuality
and sex. But in a self-respecting way.
Yes.
And she
was in control.
From nobody.
She was in control.
And that's what Bossy is spelling out.
Exactly.
You're not going to diss her.
So she's done three records. This is her fourth now. The first three were done in collaboration with the Neptunes. We've talked about them before on Sound Opinions, this production team of Pharrell Williams and Chad Hugo that dominated R&B and hip-hop from the late 90s up until, you know, the last few weeks. I mean, you can find records of theirs on the charts somehow.
Yeah.
And Khalees was one of their early discoveries. She was making quirky, off-the-wall R&B. She was sort of bridging the gap between that whole neo-soul movement, all those Earth Mother-type singers like Erykah Badu.
And Jill Scott.
And contemporary R&B, the world of Missy Elliott and the people who were getting on the charts all the time. She never quite fit comfortably into either one of those worlds.
Little
she was kind of a freak.
Psychedelia as
mm-hmm.
well. Well, yeah, rainbow-colored hair.
Yeah.
And the first album in 99 was called Kaleidoscope. And yeah.
So Khalees Rogers, born in Harlem, now married to Nas, the famous New York City rap star. She's got quite a little career going without actually fitting comfortably in anyone's niche. She is nobody's mannequin. She is nobody's Svengali-like creation. And on her fourth album, I think one of her final gestures to indicate that she is a completely independent woman is to say, okay, I've had all the success with Pharrell and Chad and with the Neptunes guys. I'm not going to record with them anymore. I'm going to go on and do my own thing. I mean, everybody was lining up to record with her. Khalees was here. She's got an A-list of producers on this record. Rafael Sadiq, Scott Storch, Will.i.am, Swizz Beatz.
Max Martin, the guy behind all those Britney Spears and Backstreet Boys NSYNC records. Linda Perry, we were talking about last week, crafting half of the Christina Aguilera record.
Sure. She is the queen of all flavors on this record. And many, many producers as opposed to the exclusive deal that she had with Neptunes in the past. So from album number four, Khalees was here. Let's play one of the new tracks. It's called Blindfold Me on Sound Opinions.
Let's just say I like to take chances.
Khalees,
blindfold me.
Khalees, Blindfold, from her fourth album, Khalees Was Here. this is a fascinating record, Craig. She just will not be pigeonholed anywhere. She's proudly a born-again Christian, and yet Blindfold Me is, how do we say this discreetly? She's advocating being deprived of her eyesight prior to a sexual congress there. You know, Milkshake was also skirting that line, like you said last time. We have many of the tracks on this album doing the same thing. A song like Don't Think So. That's her response both to the guy who wants to get in her pants and anybody who wants to tell her to be nice. Like You is another sexy kind of playground rap, come on, that is scored, believe it or not, to a sample of a Mozart aria. Mm-hmm. I really can't think of too many hip-hop tracks that are based on an opera vocal sample. I mean, that's bizarre. Despite the fact that you have so many different producers, yeah, the record is schizophrenic, but I think that that's part of her charm. She's just all over the map, going from this kind of sexy, smoky R&B crooning to that little girl on helium from outer space Martian voice there. I'm just a sucker for it. I will say that at 18 tracks plus a bonus track that apparently was included on the album against her objections. It's her take on some other female pop stars, I gather. She's just dissing them left and right.
Yeah.
And is angry at the record company. So here she is, arguably the biggest release of her career, and the first thing she did to promote it was declare war with her record company. Her second album, despite the first one having been a huge hit in Asia and Europe, never even came out in the States. I mean, she just won't take guff from anybody. I love that about her. Boy, I love what's here.
You know, I wish I loved it more because I think Khaleesi's, you know, she's shown me quite a bit with those first three Neptunes records. And I think what she's done here, Jim, is turned into just another pretty voice. She's another R&B singer.
Oh,
she's
no.
She's part of that assembly line.
No.
Her personality has been buffed out.
How can you say that? Look at all the weirdness on this record.
There's not enough. Well, there's weirdness, but it sounds like recycled Khaleesi weirdness. I mean, those tracks, Bossy and What's That Right There, taste like those sour milkshake leftovers. I mean, it's like milkshake part three and part four and part five. And yeah, we get it. You're kind of freaky and you have, you know, sexual self-empowerment going for you. And and guys better watch out when they step to you. But you can't continue to recycle the formula. I don't hear the personality.
It's a great formula. We were defending Slayer for recycling its formula for 30 years, you know.
Yeah,
I'll take this formula any day.
But she's playing somebody else's game. She's not playing her own game now. She's playing Scott Storch's game and Will.i.am's game and Swizz Beatz's game.
No way.
You know, there's a variety of settings. As you said here, there's glam rock, there's flamenco, there's a twee pop song that CeeLo does for her.
Yeah, CeeLo. You know, the voice of Gnarls Barkley is on there. But listen to that song.
But she sounds more like those guys about their personalities than hers, and I want to hear her.
I disagree with it. You know, she's singing in Little Star, the song that CeeLo joins her on. There's nothing special about me. I'm just a little star. And then CeeLo Green comes in and says, "You just keep trying and trying. You sure look like a star to me." I think that is a perfect summation of her entire career. That is the Khaleesi story. I mean, I love her. Buy it. Buy two copies. Sell me yours.
She's made,
I can have an extra.
For the first time in her career, she has made an assembly line R&B record. She has and tasted the Big Apple.
Oh, no.
And she says,
no,
I want more of that. I want to sell millions and millions of records.
No way.
It's not about me anymore, about my personality. It's about how many records I can sell.
Oh, no.
And I think this smacks of sellout. I think this is a huge disappointment.
If it's about how many records, the first thing she does is declare war on the record company because she's angry. She did this track almost as a goof in the studio. They recorded, they included on the album as a bonus, and the first thing she does is declare war with a record company. That means she's eager to sell out. And who do you think hired all these producers? She chose them, and she got from them.
She chose them for a reason, to get on the charts. She wants to get on the charts.
The perception existed that the Neptunes, you know, were basically using her as their vocal mouthpiece, and she didn't want that. So I think she's firmly in charge here.
Yeah,
I bet she'd kick your butt if she knew what you were saying about it. You're talking smack about it.
I don't doubt that, but I think actually she was more in charge when she was working with the Neptunes because they allowed her personality to flourish. In this case, she just sounds like any other R&B singer sort of plugged into these slots.
I've said it's a buy it. What are you giving it?
You know, at best, there's eight tracks on here that I want to hear. That's a burn it record for me.
Before we ever saw
There was a big bang once, and now we're learning to use our thumbs. Song about the great Darwinian versus creationism debate that rages on today. That is a band called Cursive from Omaha, Nebraska, who have just released a new album called Happy Hollow. A little bit of backstory here, Greg. I got to confess that I had written off, as many critics have, I think, Cursive as the kind of inferior younger brother band to fellow Nebraskans Bright Eyes. They were the much-hyped emo heroes. Cursive was kind of following in their trail, but they never really fit neatly into the emo pigeonhole. And that started to really become obvious in 2003 with an album called The Ugly Organ, where Tim Kasher flipped that traditional, underplayed but nevertheless undeniable emo, you know, the girl broke my heart and screwed me over kind of songwriting viewpoint by writing from the viewpoint of the girl, mm-hmm. which I thought was interesting. At the same time, they had some deeper, you know, non-emo flourishes to the music. It was more indie rock, and there was a cello. Now, on this record, Happy Hollow, they've replaced the cellist with a really kind of kicking horn section mm-hmm. and injected a heaping dose of that new wave of new wave sound that everybody, you know, that seemingly every other band we're hearing these days in the alt-rock world is enamored, wants to be kind of Morrissey or Echo and the Bunnymen and, you know, going back to that 80s new wave sound. It works, I think, for Cursive because there's a real ambition to this record. The cover art intentionally evokes Bruce Springsteen's Greetings from Asbury Park, New Jersey, with the kind of the postcard. And Happy Hollow is kind of a Sherwood Anderson, our town conceit. This is a small town in America. These are guys, again, from Omaha. And every one of the 14 songs, which they call Hymns for Heathens on this record, is addressing the question of religion and what it means in people's lives, how it is used as a panacea or a retreat from reality or justification for endless hypocrisies. Each of these songs is trying to get at this bigger theme from the perspective of a different resident of this little town, including the parishioner and an older mom and younger kid, a kid who's about to go off to war and fight for God and country and flag and family. That's an awful lot to chew. Boy, that's heavy duty. So let's talk in a little bit about whether they succeeded or not. But first we'll hear a song. I think it really kind of sums up what this album is about. It's called Retreat! With the exclamation point there, which I happen to think is the best Letter to God song since Dear God by XTC. In this one, which comes smack dab in the middle of the album, they're not writing really from a perspective of the townsfolk. They're writing directly to God. Mm-hmm. So, God, listen up on Sound Opinions.
Retreat from Cursive, the new record Happy Hollow. They've been around for a decade, as Jim indicated. And as you also mentioned, in the shadow of Conor Oberst and that whole Omaha scene, Conor Oberst, the leader of the band Bright Eyes, getting all the hype, getting all the notoriety. He's the doe-eyed poster boy
handsome
for that
boy.
Whole emo yeah. rock movement. But I got to say, Kasher's every bit the songwriter that Oberst is.
Tim Kasher,
and
yeah.
And in some ways, a better one. Not as much melodrama. But
yeah.
the ambition is definitely there. I mean, these are multi-part songs. Even though they're only 3 or 4 minutes long, there's 4 or 5 things, you know, happening in the songs at the same time. And they're kind of jagged-edged. And there's a sense of, man, you know, it's almost chaotic. And there's almost too much information being thrown mm-hmm, at you at mm-hmm. one time. And, you know, and on first listen, it can be overwhelming. But I got to say, I lived with this record for a couple of weeks. And by the end of it, I was like, wow, this is like one of the most ambitious indie rock records I think I've ever heard. He pulls it off really well. The hooks are sneaky, but they're sneaky good. Eventually, every one of these songs hits you with something that you're going to take away from it and be humming the horn riff or the guitar solo or a bit of a chorus weeks later. And he's tackling really knotty metaphysical subjects, as you pointed out. And we were talking about, you know, the childhood dreams versus the soul-sucking adult jobs, you know. Evolution versus creationism, sin and redemption, faith, you know, and fanaticism.
Well, and, you know, look, he does come from that emo world, even if he's not emo. So occasionally he does, in the cardigan-wearing sensitive soul. Yeah, right. There's a line in here, time to stick a fork in the merciless socket of time. You know, and it's like, okay there, Jack. Maybe you should have edited that one a little.
But the one thing I got to say is he never seems to take himself so seriously that you feel like he is thinking of himself as some kind of oracle or poet.
Yeah.
There's a lot of fun in this record. There's a lot of exuberance in the way it's performed.
Oh, absolutely.
They're having a ball.
Well, I think the XTC analogy we can draw even beyond Retreat and its similarities to Dear God. You know, before... When XTC was still touring, when it was actually in the new wave era, there was that kind of genre blind, you know, we'll throw anything and everything and the kitchen sink into a pop song, but it's always going to be a pop song.
Right.
It's always going to be 3.5 minutes long. It's going to be catchy, and we can deal with heavy subjects, but you're going to go away humming it. So in addition to that kind of new wave underpinning, you've got ska, you've got no wave and skronk and weird jazz things. But man, just when you think they're going to lose the plot, the horns come in or a big chorus comes in. And
carry you away. Yeah,
this,
it wins
this is
the
a
day.
Great record. This is a really, really interesting record. I got to say, it's a buy it.
Oh, absolutely. I've been a Cursive fan. I saw them, and I have to admit this. We talked about this at least with a couple of the other members of the Sound Opinions team when we were out at Lollapalooza. And I got to say, I was completely unimpressed by their live set. I just thought that was a shambles. And
I thought it was a mess.
Oh, my God.
I did not like it.
You know, this record is not going to be all that great.
Yeah.
But I, you know, as I said, I spent a little time with the record, and I go, man, the ambition of the songwriting here is really first rate. And not only that, but the melodies and all the other big ideas sort of caught up with the ambition to the point where you realize, he's actually pulled this off.
I think at Lollapalooza they came across as just another kind of Cure or Echo and the Bunnymen wannabe new wave revival band. You know, this is a band you want to see in a club. You want to have those horns really kicking. You want to be able to listen to the lyrics. I mean, I hate to say such a rock critic-like cliche. You know what I mean? Because really, if the music doesn't kick, you know, I don't care what they're saying
absolutely.
In the lyrics. But the added pleasure of really diving into this record, man, that's a heavy-duty concept to write about.
Yeah, there's some big ideas floating around in this record, and he presents it as pop music, you know, and I think, you know, at the end of the day, that's what Pete Townsend and Ray Davies were doing back in the 60s, you know,
and I'm not
saying he's the new Pete Townsend or Ray Davies, but he's a damn good songwriter, and I got to say, right now, he's the best songwriter out of Omaha, Nebraska, if nothing else.
Yeah, I don't know how much competition. As a double buy it for Cursive's Happy Hollow, we have two more highly anticipated records to review before the end of this record review show on Sound Opinions, The Roots' latest and M. Ward's new album. You can catch up on all of our record reviews from the show. You can read them again and listen a bit if you go to the read section of our website, soundopinions.org. We'll be right back with Sound Opinions on Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media.
Ourselves for what is really the issue. And then behind that all lies a very personal and human feeling that I don't think old men ought to promote wars for young men to fight.
A man is lost somewhere inside of Littleton. 11 million children are on the Ritalin. That's why I don't need for the sake of Ritalin. False media, we don't need it, do we? Pilgrim, slave, Indian, Mexican. It looks real.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. There is a dark and scary and typically heavy track called False Media by The Roots from their new album, Game Theory. Greg, it always amuses me when you read critics writing about The Roots. They seem equally divided in making a comparison to The Grateful Dead in the sense that The Roots are one of the best live jam bands, although there's no flaccid wankery, you know, in The Roots. But there is this fluid kind of jamming quality when they play live, and also the band, in the sense of the band backing Dylan, because The Roots are a great group that's been employed by many other hip-hop and R&B greats, mm-hmm. from D'Angelo to Common, and they've made some incredible albums on their own. I think everybody would agree that 1999's Things Fall Apart is their masterpiece. Even as a dedicated hardcore Roots fan, I was worrying that they were losing the plot a little bit on, especially on the last record, 2004's The Tipping Point. You're starting to think that, well, the driving force here, the drummer, Amir Questlove Thompson, maybe he's finally been so distracted by all the other production work he's doing and all the other Roots are playing on dozens of people's different albums. Maybe they've kind of lost the quality control for actual Roots albums. Now along comes Game Theory, which once again sees Amir kind of driving the band, and Black Thought, the rap name that he's chosen, it's an artist by the name of Tariq Trotter, being the primary voice. Although, as always on Roots albums, there are a couple of other guest rappers coming and going, including a guy named Malik B, and a real presence out of Philadelphia, a very comedic rapper named Petey Crack, or Petey Petey, P-E-E-D-I. Let's hear a little of this. As always, with the music of The Roots, I mean, they're all over the place. There's a classic bite on the first single from Kool & the Gang, and there's a snippet of Radiohead driving a song called Atonement and everything in between. The song that we're going to play is called In the Music. It's by The Roots from Game Theory on Sound Opinions.
Sightseeing, don't visit there. It's somewhere between Jersey and Delaware. Philly never scared, and them niggas ain't timid there. Them young triggers lose lives by the minute there. It might start, but the fight never finished there. They all oofed up, trying to get the gingerbread. A few stacks be the price for it in the head. Cops and robbers, cowboys and Indians, clips and revolvers and Georges and Benjamins. A celebration of the loss of your innocence. To your old self, you lost any resemblance. They say the city make a dark impression. The youth just lost and they want direction. But they don't get the police, they get the protection. And walk around with heat like Charlton Heston, man.
In the Music from The Roots, their new album, Game Theory, that is the centerpiece of the album as far as I'm concerned, Jim. It pretty much sums up the tone of this album, the most somber and perhaps the darkest record The Roots have ever made. There's a lot of issues sort of hanging over it, the war in Iraq, urban crime, what's going on post-9/11 in this country, the decay of the inner city. That track, you definitely get the sense of this, like, bombed out car or a panther strolling through this urban wasteland and just sort of surveying the streets and here's my life. You know?
I didn't want to tip my hand when I was setting up the record. To me, this is there's a riot going on mm-hmm. by Sly and the Family Stone for the new millennium.
Just about every Roots album that I can think of has a track like that that to me just sort of stops you dead in your tracks and you go, wow, that's a tour de force. I mean, that's just a brilliant track for Amir Thompson, the drummer, those reverberating snare hits, the undulating guitars underneath it. To me, if every track on the album was as good as this, it would have been the Roots' best album. Unfortunately, I think this album is another erratic showing from the Roots.
Oh.
You mentioned very well that there's no doubt about Things Fall Apart from 1999 being their masterpiece. Ever since then, it's sort of been hit and miss for me. And again, I think Game Theory falls into that category.
Oh, you're nuts.
You got to understand about this group. They changed the game in 93. When they introduced their first record, Organics, it was all about not so much the primacy of the MC, that larger-than-life figure at the front of the hip-hop group. And it wasn't really about the DJ either, because they really didn't emphasize turntables.
No.
It was all about this sort of organic collection of characters creating songs within a hip-hop context. This album, again, is all over the map. But for whatever reason... There's not enough consistency here. There's way too many ballads, way too many snoozy ballads packed in at the end of this record. I think it really falls off in its second half. There's a really lame, and I mean lame, rap rock track that Limp Bizkit would have used as a B-side. Here I Come at the end of the record. I just think this kind of stuff is beneath the Roots, whose quality control is usually pretty impeccable. I just think they've sort of been distracted for whatever reason on their recent album.
Look, I think what you're missing here is that this is a 47-minute, 13-song suite. And with the exception of the last track on the album, which is called Can't Stop This, which is very much like the song we were making such ardent fun of last week, Thank You, Dedication to Fans, from the Christina Aguilera
that's
record.
That's 8 minutes to excuse, man. That's,
all right, but listen, that is their tribute to their brother and the late producer and a good friend of theirs, Jay Dilla.
Save it for the liner notes.
Common talked about him when we interviewed
him on the
show. We
miss you, Jay Dilla. That would have been fine.
It uses the same cheesy gambit of voicemail messages, paying homage to this guy.
It's called filler.
But it's at the end of the album. Greg, if you take that out of the mix, you've got this 40-minute, 12-song pastiche of songs that can't really be judged separately. You are always a sucker for that sort of thing. Like There's a Riot Going On. You know, Sly and the Family Stone previously had been known for singles. Then this album comes out that looks at the devastation in the wake of 68 and the riots in Watts and Newark, New Jersey, and the fact that the only way out of the ghettos is by being killed in Vietnam or killed on the streets, okay? That's what this album is doing here. And, you know, the songs, taking them individually, don't really work. I think that this album is the best thing they've done since Things Fall Apart. And I'm just shocked. I don't think you did your homework well enough, because it's a deep album and it's a dark album. You're saying there's no consistency. There's emotional vibe that, with the exception of that closing track, runs through every song here.
I'll tell you what's inconsistent about it. When you put tracks like Living in a New World, which sounds like a pretty bad Beck track, if you ask me. Clock with No Hands, a pretty...
You don't like that song.
Snoozy ballad.
I think it's great.
Atonement, another snoozy ballad right on top of it. Right before that, you've got that song Long Time, which is okay. Here I Come, which is that awful rap rock track. The song Baby, which is, to me, like pop trifle. I mean, that's the second half of the record, Jim. I'm finding difficulty finding a song in there. And then you've got that 8-minute Jay Dilla tribute at the end. I give it a burn it record because I really respect these guys. And I think, as I said, In the Music is a masterpiece. But it is not a complete album.
I think it's a buy-it album. And the only track that's really skippable is that last one, Can't Stop This. But there's no accounting for taste.
When one or two won't do, 'cause I want it all. And I sip or a spoonful won't do. No, I want it all.
No, you're not listening to a very old man sitting in his basement in the South singing circa 1933. That is, in fact, Matt Ward, a.k.a. M. Ward, who is from California, now records in Portland, and this is his fifth record. It's called Postwar, and that particular track is Poison Cup. Ward is one of those singer-songwriter types who has gained quite a bit of respect from his fellow indie musicians around the country. He's recorded tracks with Death Cab for Cutie's Ben Gibbard, Jenny Lewis of Rilo Kiley, Connor Oberst of Bright Eyes. He was discovered in the 90s by one Jason Lytle of Granddaddy, who recorded his first group, Rodriguez. Jason Lytle, who we just had on Sound Opinions a few weeks ago, was the first guy to really give M. Ward a shot and get and bring his songwriting out into the open. Hal Gelb, the mastermind of the Arizona desert rock band Giant Sand, then recorded Ward's guitar playing for a primarily guitar-based debut solo record. So Ward was primarily known as this masterful guitar player before anybody really knew much about that singing voice. That sort of deep, dark, ancient sound that he's able to conjure once he opens his mouth. He says he got that from singing in his bedroom. He had to sing very quietly. He didn't want to disturb his neighbors, didn't want to disturb his parents when he was 16 years old, practicing in his bedroom. He's been recording steadily ever since with the help of Jason Lytle and Hal Gelb. He launched a solo career, has been signed to Merge Records, one of the most respected independent labels in the country. Well-received records in 2003, The Transfiguration of Vincent, and in 2004 with Transistor Radio. Still very much lo-fi kind of recordings, very intimate-sounding records. He hired Mike Mogus, the guy who does a lot of the recordings for the Omaha, Nebraska label Saddle Creek, to be his producer for Postwar. And I think the differences are pretty telling. Mogus brings a new clarity to what Ward is doing on this record that he's never really been able to evince before on his recorded output. I think the new record is sort of a step up in terms of just the sound quality of it. It's called Postwar, and here's a track from it. It's called To Go Home from Sound Opinions, and it's M. Ward.
Greg, I have a sneaky suspicion that you're loving this record. I can tell by the gleam in your eye. And also, it kind of stinks of being a cot record, actually. But, Greg, I think you're buying the hype, man, because music bloggers out there and fanzine types are banding together and saying this is one of the indie records of the year. And they're hearing something I'm not, or at least not entirely. One of the things people are saying is that this is kind of a concept album. People are saying this is kind of a musical equivalent of The Deer Hunter for the war in Iraq, about returning veterans questioning shattered lives. And that actually is true of the best parts of this album. I think Daniel Johnston's To Go Home was chosen because it kind of comments about that. The songs Chinese Translation, Right in the Head, Requiem are all kind of fitting in that concept mode. And they're really well written. I think his voice, which recalls Elliott Smith, and his guitar playing, which he was part of a tribute album to John Fahey. He was really the driving person there. Fahey's finger-picking style is really what he's doing and taking somewhere new. It all kind of comes together in those couple of songs. The other half of the album sucks. This guy falls prey to such pretensions and such pointless eclecticism. You've got this jazzy shuffle thing happening on Eyes on the Prize and Roller Coaster and Afterward Rag. It's almost as bad as the Bing Crosby stuff that Dylan is giving us. And then you've got this surf instrumental. I have no idea what it's doing there. It's called Neptune's Net. It's filler, garbage, or worse. And then, you know, like a really bad hip-hop album where the rapper invites everybody and his uncle and all their friends and family to come and guest rap. You've got an indie rock all-star cast popping by here. Nico Case and Jim James of My Morning Jacket and Rachel Blumberg of The Decemberists. And it's like, you know, hey, listen, man, Matt, if you could focus on the things that you do well and concentrate on that over the course of the whole album, this might have been worth listening to. But as it is, it's a real mixed bag.
Well, first of all, I think you got to stop reading those critics, because I never read any of those criticisms of this record. I thought concept record with a deer hunter about coming back from a war. What's he going on about? That
post-war?
I'm sorry.
Look at the lyrics of those songs.
Don't get it.
Look at the lyrics of those
songs. But, Jim, if you believe...
Right in the head. He's coming back. He's not right in the head. He's lost his mind.
If you believe the hype, go with it, Jim. I have no idea what you're talking about. I have to say, the only reason I appreciated this record is the atmosphere it creates. You mentioned Afterward as being one of the reasons you don't like this record. I think you're crazy. That is a beautiful, lush... To my mind, when I heard that song, I thought... Here's a guy who understands why those doo-wop records by the Flamingos were so great. He understands that atmosphere. He's got that atmosphere. This is a record that from that very first track, Poison Cup. It sucks you in. He creates his world. He builds it. He keeps you there, and you don't come out until the very last song. I think it's a wonderful, atmospheric, beautiful record. I think that song, Chinese Translation, in which he sort of finds this wise man under a tree, who I think is God. You talk about Cursive's Tim Casher writing a letter to God. I think this is another one of those letter to God type songs. And God says, I don't have much time for you. You've only got 3 questions you can ask me. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just a wonderful little parable, kind of song that Dylan would have written. I think this guy is a very modest songwriter in his own way, but I love the way he creates atmosphere in his songs, whether it's a gospel rave-up like the one you criticized, Magic Trick, which I think is a wonderful song, to that To Go Home song. I just think it's a wonderful record, and I think the main reason it succeeds is that despite his virtuosity as a guitar player and despite the big deal that people make about his voice, it's all about the songs for this guy and creating this rich
and
atmosphere.
And the surf instrumental, how's that fit in?
It's a wonderful song. It's a wonderful song. And it fits in beautifully because it's a nice little, you know, respite after that big gospel number.
Yeah. You
it's a linking
the,
song.
You drank the Kool-Aid on this guy. Yeah. I don't know. You know, this record, man, the more I listened to it, the less I liked it. I don't know how you're missing the kind of Iraq underpinning thing. I mean, because it is there in a lot of these songs.
Oh, I don't doubt it's there. I'm just saying that's not the main reason I'm drawn to it. The concept is, you know, whatever the concept is, I don't care. I think it's just a beautiful, beautiful record.
You're equivocating on the Roots album, and you're championing this thing. Man, I don't know. This is a burn it record as far as I'm concerned for the first half, which is pretty decent, and then the second half just goes right in the trash. You're advocating people buy this with cash money.
I would say, you know, the Afterward song is about a minute and a half. If somebody downloads that and says they don't like it, then fine. They shouldn't listen to this record. But to me, in my mind, I just listen to that minute and a half of music, and my breath is taken away. That's the reason I listen to music.
Wow, you like this guy.
Buy a record all the way.
Well, Greg, diversity of opinions there. You look like you want to kill me right now. You can go convene with your M Ward. I respect you.
Oh, don't worry. I'm just you know, I'm sad for you, Jim, because you're missing out on a great record.
I'm loving the Roots. You can catch up on all these record reviews by going to our website and going to the read section of soundopinions.org. You can hear them again, hear some samples, and actually give us your feedback, give us your reviews of anything we talk about here on the show at any time at interact@soundopinions.org.
Next week, Jim, we've got a great show. Warren Haynes is going to be in with his band Government Mule. We've had Warren in here solo before, but this time it's going to be the full-on Government Mule boogie stomp. Metal meets blues meets soul.
Man, the hardest rockin' jam band. Really the only jam band in the universe today that doesn't lose the plot. We have some thank yous to say on the way out. Tori Malatia is, as always, our executive producer. Todd Bachman's our managing producer and director. Matt Spiegel is our producer. Our associate producers are Jason Saldana and Robin Lynn. We get some legal help from Dino Armiros, some technical assistance from Joe Dassault, and Jim Russell is our man at American Public Media.
And Jim, I'm going to head out right now. I'm going to help Bob Dylan find Alicia Keys. I think the two of us, we're going to cook up some pork chops.
I tell you, we'd have a pledge drive show if we could bring those two together.